fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Devin Whitmire. People from South Carolina, like myself, are proud of their state, but even we don't know every nook and cranny or every piece of culture or history. To explore places that are off the beaten path, you have to talk to the people there, because their stories make everything come together. From Discover South Carolina, it's the Palmetto Porch, premiering September 18th. To learn more, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that our government is shady, but every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens invading, fluoride in the water, they spray our skies daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
What, they don't want to listen to you? No, they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know. If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
Atlantis, a land that harnessed the power of a volcano's fiery heart and learned to store the energy of the sun in giant crystals, then use them to create secret weapons whose disintegrating rays could destroy the rest of the world.
I've been hooked like phonics since geometric platonic solids first solidified in my conscience. An enigmatic, spastic, autodidactic, mystery scholastic. Got drastic with Spartan tactics, Atlantis scholar stretching facts like mental gymnastics. Stepped into a scripted, systematic, circular logic labyrinth. Walls collapsing, all nails to a hammer and a casket. Basket cases can't grasp it. Athens barred access to the past on a lost path. To the last breath, at a vast depth, violent fast death, flash floods and the mud crept, smothered souls slept, left forgotten as the sand swept, only the stones left, old bones kept with a chipped tool set, figured in a book only dust collects, relics that merely resurrect archaeology's sense of false confidence.
Atlantean draconoids rose to prominence, eventually gained dominance, their power grew ominous, loomed over the populace, enslaved in the crystalloid metropolis.
I reject lost continents. I said I reject lost continents.
Whatever the Atlantis myth once represented has been washed from our minds by a tsunami of pop culture.
We actually find, or the evidence we find, like for example, out at the Rashat structure in Western Africa, which is, you know, supposedly this is the place where, you know, Plato was ascribing to in Atlantean capital city. They found lots of stone tools there. Archaeologists have been out there. And what nobody has found is a massive set of ruins that resemble the city in the myth. But they found a lot of stone tools, which means people were living there at some point, right? Because there's been so much water impact at that site because of the Green Sahara, what happens is that a lot of these tools get kind of washed down into these sandy depressions in between the rings of stone.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. I'm your host, Mystic Mark, and with me today, for the first time, is someone that I personally was floored when I realized, wow, I could have this guy on my podcast, because we're talking about something that I think I've been personally obsessed with, but also it fits into, and you know, forgive the pun here, but it fits into the larger puzzle of who we are, what we're doing here, and what it means to be human beings. So I'm really excited to have the creator, the director of the Atlantis puzzle. Jack, welcome to the show. For folks who are just hearing about you and your film for the first time, give us a full introduction. Tell us where we can find the film and all that good stuff.
I'm Jack Kelly. I'm the director of the new documentary, The Atlantis Puzzle, which is now out across North America. And hopefully by the time that folks listen to this, it'll be out worldwide. So we're on all the usual platforms, Amazon, Google Play, you know, YouTube Movies, and with others, it'll be rolling out and it'll be on Prime Video internationally. So really excited to share the project with a global audience, because I think the subject of Atlantis has mystified people across the globe for, at the very least, centuries, if not thousands of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember first pondering the possibility of these, you know, faraway, long-lost ancient civilizations. And when you learn about it, at least from my perspective, when I first heard and learned about Atlantis, it felt like a sort of open and shut case, like, oh yeah, this is a myth that cultures have passed down to us, and it's a, you know, an allegory or whatever. And I didn't look into it really much until I started to do some digging into my own backyard here in New England, where I live, and we find, you know, certain structures made of stone that are dated to well beyond the traditional timelines of when certain groups of people were here or not here in America. But what really was profound, and I think kind of threw me for a loop personally with everything I've kind of dove into with, you know, as it pertains to Atlantis, was where the Atlantis puzzle maybe has gone too far afield, right? We've maybe been looking in the wrong direction for maybe as long as, you know, our modern understanding of Atlantis has existed. So let's begin to kind of piece this together for people. Like, where did you initially stumble upon this story? Because it's my understanding that, you know, as a filmmaker, this kind of fell into your lap in a little sort of synchronistic way, and you came into contact with a very interesting gentleman who has essentially retranslated Plato's work, right? So tell me about that. Not all of his work, but specific pieces of his work pertaining to Atlantis, right? So tell us about this and how this all transpired.
Yeah, sure. So it's like you said, it was just a series of unexpected events that resulted in the film that people are seeing today, right? So I was on vacation on the Greek island of Santorini and literally just stumbled over a book that happened to have a couple articles in it by this guy, and his name is George Sarantidis. He's a Greek researcher who's from Athens, Greece. He's an older gentleman. And about maybe 20 years ago, I guess, he became really deeply fascinated by the question of why Plato, who was a very rational philosopher and really the foundational thinker, I think we could say, of the Western canon, why would this guy write what most people feel like is a sort of fairy tale-like myth, right? And I think, as I've talked about in other places, I think that didn't sit quite right with George, and being that he was familiar with ancient Greek and, you know, had this sort of engineering logician type background, he really started to dig into this in the kind of really rigorous way that I think is open to people who are dedicated amateur researchers, right? So he's not a professor at Athens University, although he did work with a professor there to work on his translations. And what he wound up retranslating was Plato's two books, Timaeus and Critias. And those are the two books that contain the Atlantis story, or at least as far as we know, that's the first appearance of that story in, you know, in what we call the historical period, right?
Now, what exactly was the title of the book you found? Because I found this point kind of interesting as well.
Yeah, I wish I could remember exactly what it is, but it's something like the Atlantis Conference, and it was from 2008.
Right.
And you know, again, this was just a random coincidence, right? I'm in a hotel on Santorini. I was going to visit Akrotiri, which is an ancient, probably Minoan culture site that was buried under the volcanic eruption of what was once called Thera, the island of Santorini, around 1600 BC. So that's what I was there to see. And this book literally was just sitting on a shelf in the lobby. And I'm sure you and a lot of your audience is probably familiar with, there's an idea that, you know, Santorini could have been one of Plato's inspirations for this story. And that's been popularized because, hey, it was fairly advanced ancient civilization. They had, you know, running water and toilets and multi-story buildings and stuff like that. And it was destroyed in a cataclysmic event. But it seems unlikely. But at the same time, as I'm sure you're familiar, Mark, like a lot of places will, they will latch on to a story because it helps promote tourism. So I think that there's, you know, the hotel had all these books about various different things, a lot of touristic stuff. And one of them was this book, which I have no idea how it wound up there, because I don't think the owners of the hotel or the people running it had anything to do with this. And maybe somebody left it there, but that it's the hand of fate. So often really interesting things and some of the most important things in our lives come about through quirks of fate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is the case with this show in many ways. But when it comes to Plato, there's a sort of chain of custody to where he got this story, right? It's not totally just spun out of his imagination or pieced together from other types of stories that were similar. It's in fact kind of like passed down, and maybe even, I hope I'm not giving away too much, but there's something more to this story, this Atlantis story. It's not completely meant to be read literally. There's a context to it that maybe you wouldn't right away notice.
And that's why one of the reasons why the title of the film is The Atlantis Puzzle and not The Atlantis Solution or The Atlantis Answer, because essentially, one of the elements of George Serentides' theory about all this is that Plato used mythology in his philosophical writing as a kind of teaching tool for his students. And for those people who don't know, I mean, Plato's day job was basically, he was essentially the dean of a university, right? He was the head of a place called the Academy, where he would teach kind of the best and brightest students from around Greece, including a guy named Aristotle, right? Was his star pupil. So I guess one of the questions when you look at the Atlantis story is, why did Plato write this story? And I think that's where we really try and investigate in the film. You have to be really careful, Mark, because there's a whole logic chain of decisions, right? A lot of if-then things, which is one of the reasons I think this appealed to Serentides, who had the engineering background, is these guys, you know, are always dealing with circuits and logic change and, you know, logic gates and stuff like that. Well, you could say, well, is the story totally true? That's one assumption, right? Well, if it's true, how did the story reach Plato? Because the story is set sometime around 9600 BCE, right? So in order to get down to Plato, it had to cross a span of 9,200 years or so, right? If the story is completely false, you got to ask yourself, what on earth is Plato wasting his time writing this crazy story about a lost civilization for? What's this got to do with logic and virtue and living a good life and stuff like that? But if it's neither all false nor all true, well, then there's something in the middle, right? And that then you have a challenge on your hands, right? Because if I hand you, Mark, I hand you a book and I say, look, Mark, this is all true. Well, you can just kind of turn your brain off. You say, oh, Jack says true. I mean, it's true. This is great. It's maybe this is like a science textbook or something. And if I give you something else, I say, Mark, here's a Spider-Man comic book. And you know, it's nothing in there is true. Well, you know, then you can pretty much turn your brain off. You don't really have to pay attention. You can just kind of enjoy the story, right? But if I say, Mark, here's a puzzle, and you got to figure this out, isn't that so much more interesting?
Well, and also the longevity of that seems maybe part of this whole equation where, you know, still to this day, there are so many unanswered questions pertaining to Atlantis. And as I kind of, you know, put the cart before the horse at the beginning of our conversation, like, where is Atlantis is one of these big questions. And I think, you know, Atlantis, Atlantic, right? It's there's this kind of obvious connection in the words, but maybe there's, again, taking an engineer's approach to this situation, maybe there's a more complicated reason why we have this similarity. And it's not because Atlantis was in the Atlantic, but maybe because the Atlanteans were the only ones who had access to the Atlantic from their position on the globe, or, you know, maybe were even in the Atlantic to some extent. But I heard you mention that the whole idea of sunken continents or higher or lower sea levels is really maybe taking us off course, right? And what George is it has done has kind of gone away from those, I guess, measuring and time kind of issues and gone straight to the material, the source material of what Plato is saying. And there's something in there about the pillars of Heracles, right, or Hercules, which, again, another one of these modern misnomers, is kind of conflated with the Straits of Gibraltar, when in fact this was more like a turn of phrase, not an actual geographical location. Can you help us understand what exactly that means and how the Greeks would have received that phrase, the Pillars of Hercules?
Yeah, you're bringing up a great point, Mark, which is, you know, this gets extremely complicated. We can kind of go as deep as you'd like to go, but the long and the short, and we cover all this in the film, of course, but the long and the short of it is the geography, right? Where was this place? Was it real? And all this other sort of stuff. Well, first you'd think you could go into these books and they would say something quite clear, like, you know, go to Spain and turn south and journey for 4,000 miles and you'll hit the Atlantean capital city. But that's not what Plato's books say. And part of the reason for the confusion about this over so many hundreds of years, at least in the modern era, right, is that we deal with these books in translation. So when Serenitatis's key contribution in many ways, or the thing that sparked him on his work, was the recognition that, at least in the modern era, by which I mean maybe the last 200 years, 250 years, this story had been mistranslated. And the word Okeanos, which is ancient Greek for ocean, and just for context, the ancient Greek world consisted of Europe, Africa, and Asia. That was the known world for them. Nobody had ever, as far as we know, been to Antarctica or Australia or so, you know, so forth. That question of, well, where could this place be, you know, had been translated to say, well, there was this island continent and it was in the Atlantic Ocean. But if you go back and look at the actual ancient Greek, of which I read just a small amount, it actually says something like the Atlantic Pelagos. And I've talked about this before. Pelagos is the word that means something like kind of like a smaller enclosed, partially enclosed sea. So today, modern Greeks use that same word or a derivation of it to refer to the Aegean Sea, right? It's the Aegean Pelagos. So right there and then, you know, you could imagine people saying, well, you know, maybe it meant something different at that time and so forth. But that's exactly what George did his research in. So you have geography over here and you have ancient language here. And the two things connect because words have meaning, right? And I know in our modern era, everybody's trying to change around the meaning of words, but this is an important concept, right? If Plato's using a word, he's not just sort of a lazy mouthed, you know, guy who picks his word choice at random. He's doing something very specific.
He's precise, eloquent, yeah.
Yeah, very precise guy. So it's just like if I say, hey, Mark, I've got a boat in Lake Ontario, that's very different than if I say, Mark, I've got a boat in Ontario Pond. Or I say, hey, Mark, I've got a boat on the Ontario River or the Ontario Ocean, right? Those mean something real different. So this question of geography and language is very closely tied up. And I think people will enjoy uncovering this piece by piece in the film of how did Serenitatis figure this out? And the key wound up being in grammar, right? Because again, ancient Greek is a very specific language, and I don't know, is it in your education, Mark, did you ever study Latin or Greek or anything, any of those ancient languages?
Well, unfortunately, I was not exactly the most astute student. I didn't really care for my classes, so they didn't put me in Latin because I wasn't very good in English class, which is surprising because now that's like mostly what I do is like communication, writing. And so, right. Yeah, you know, school really did a number on me, but no Latin.
I hear you. Listen, I really owe an apology to my high school Latin teacher because I hated Latin. I thought this was a waste of time. Was anybody studying this? I was just taking it because I thought that it would help me with, you know, science and, you know, I wanted to be a doctor and all this kind of stuff. But what you realize is there's enormous grammatical complexity in these ancient languages, and they're not less complex. They're not more primitive than modern languages. In many cases, they're more sophisticated. And that's really fascinating. So anyway, long story short, through the use of grammar, Serenitatis really carefully reread this story because he understood this too. He said, look, either this is all made up or it's not all made up, and either there are parts of it are true or there are parts that are not true. Well, if it's not all made up, then I have a responsibility to try and figure out which parts are true and refer to real things or places and which parts are not and do not. And, you know, I'll just go out on a limb and say, I think there's the reason why an academic never figured this out is because actually the reason that Atlantis has taken on this life of crazy fringe theories and really Hollywood nutty stuff, Aquaman kind of stuff, and, you know, just guys riding around on sharks underwater and fighting with tridents and stuff like that, you know, shooting each other with laser blasters. So that's sort of taken us away from what the original story was about. So anyway, Serenitatis pieced together this geography, and I think he did an incredibly compelling job at this. And at the same time, what he demonstrated very clearly right on the page, it doesn't say anything about the Atlantic Ocean. If you read the grammar correctly, it doesn't say that this continent sank, right? It basically describes an earthquake and a flood that damaged the Atlantean capital city. And so that's a premise that we explore in the Atlantis puzzle.
Right. And I think the assumption when someone hears maybe in less detail that Atlantis was an advanced technology, you know, technologically advanced society, rather, you know, your imagination runs wild. You're thinking, you know, flying cars, you're thinking, you know, portals and all this kind of stuff. But advanced technology within a certain context could mean a lot of things that maybe nowadays we take for granted with our modern, you know, innovation. A lot of the things that would have taken, you know, years of study and calculation are now done through computers, right? Ocean navigation, keeping track of the stars for that purpose of ocean navigation. I mean, these are advanced things. And One of the areas you've explored is the history of ocean travel, seafaring. These are things we've talked about a lot on the show. I'm not sure if you're familiar, you must be, with Thor Heyerdahl. He definitely fits into maybe the more fringe category of Atlantean researchers in a certain way. But in another way, he's actually proven that long journeys across the ocean are possible in very rudimentary, you know, boats. Even, you know, as something as simple as a raft can get you a very far distance across the ocean without even a sail. So with that in mind, you know, what are some of the major pieces involving seafaring that help us understand the larger picture here with Atlantis? Because, and I don't mean to throw too many questions at you, but, you know, it's kind of the misnomer is like, well, where was Atlantis? And maybe we're thinking about it wrong. Maybe this society was so advanced, it would be like, you know, us today, where America, you know, we have bases on every continent in nearly every country that we're allies with. Those are all American products flowing through those bases. If somebody archaeologically found that 200 years ago, they'd say, oh, there's an American Coca-Cola can here in Russia. How could this must be America too, right? Or, you know, whatever Russia's name will be in 2,000 million years or whatever, right? You get my point. So help us understand, like, some of these, I guess we could call it advanced technologies that maybe are overlooked nowadays.
Sure. Well, one of the most remarkable aspects of researching this film, and we spent years, you know, fact-checking everything, and I had conversations with about a dozen PhDs because, you know, I wanted to take this subject seriously, because I felt there's some real, once you strip away the fantasy mark, you know, then you're left with what to me are the real mysteries, right? And one of the things that I thought was sure to be false was the idea that people had boats, you know, in 10,000 BC. Well, because basically the story says that, you know, the Atlanteans kind of swept across North Africa, conquering everybody. And they took control of kind of the Western Mediterranean up to central Italy, right? So that's the backdrop for people who aren't familiar with the myth. So that necessitates boats, right? I mean, these guys weren't walking on water or swimming across the Mediterranean, right? You need a boat to get there. In Plato's books, you know, the characters telling the story describe the size of the armada of just the capital region of the Atlantean Empire. And that region alone was said to have, you know, a navy of 1,200 boats with, I think, 200 guys a pop in these boats. And right then and there, you've got a navy that is as large or larger than any known navy of Plato's era, right? The size, but, you know, we'll come back to this, but the size is remarkably similar to the size of the Greek fleet in the Iliad, which is, I think, 1,186 ships. And it's also very similar to the estimated size of Xerxes' fleet when the Persian Empire attacked the Greeks during the Persian Wars, although part of that fleet got wrecked in a storm. So, you know, this idea of seafaring, you know, this is one of the first questions I asked was, well, wait a minute, how could any of this be true? Because you're telling me that basically Stone Age people were out paddling around in large boats crossing the Mediterranean in, you know, 12,000 years ago. Surely that couldn't be true. And if you pick up most textbooks that, you know, somebody, some kid is reading in junior high or something, and it's going to have, it might mention boats, and usually they're sort of said to have come about in Egypt or maybe the Middle East, you know, the Fertile Crescent, the Tigris and the Euphrates and all that sort of stuff. So I always thought that was the case. I always thought, well, boats came about maybe 4,000 BC or something, somewhere in the Middle East, somewhere in Egypt, and that's just how it was, right? That's totally untrue. So I'm actually very intrigued in this subject and maybe doing a future documentary about it. But the long and the short of it is that there is evidence, not in the form of boats that exist, right? The oldest boat that exists is called the Pessa canoe, and it's about 10,000 years old. But it was dug up by accident in the Netherlands while some construction company was building a highway through a peat bog, right? So somebody hit this thing, dug it up, and said, "Hey, that looks like a canoe." Turned out that's what it was. And you'd say, well, why aren't all these boats sitting around in museums? Well, the fact is that all these boats are made out of wood, and therefore they rot. They don't last more than 1,000 years unless they're trapped in very specific conditions, like a peat bog or like being trapped in clay.
Right.
So you'd say, well, how do I know that boats go back farther in time if I can't see them? And the best way to do that is through indirect evidence, right? So you mentioned this question earlier about, you know, ancient people and societies. Well, you might be familiar with these footprints they found down in White Sands here in New Mexico.
Yes.
And these fossilized footprints demonstrate that people have unequivocally been here in the United States, what's now the United States, North America, for at least 10,000 years earlier than was previously, you know, understood by the academic establishment, right? So it's totally reset what we think of. And now, we didn't find necessarily the bones of those people, but we found their footprints. So we have indirect evidence that they were here. So this is where I'm going with this, is how do you figure out that boats were around if you don't have the boats? Well, you have to look at islands that were never attached to the mainland. And you pointed out something earlier. Sea levels, you know, have risen considerably since the early Holocene. And that's where I think a lot of people get this idea of a flood, right? That you know, society must have been flooded. And certainly the continental shelves got flooded, right? Well, as it turns out, Mark, if you go to like Crete, which is the largest island in Greece, you're going to find evidence that there are, you know, people have been there. There are stone tools shaped by people that go back not just to like 9 or 10,000 BC, which is the era of the Atlantis story, but they go back 25,000, 40,000, 80,000, over 125,000 years ago. And what's remarkable is this is not the only place. First of all, Crete was never attached to the Greek mainland, no matter how far, well, for the last 5 million years, right? So certainly in the time frame of humanity, it's been detached. And second of all, on a lot of other Greek islands, you find the same thing. And what's remarkable there is some of the tools you find on some of these islands, Mark, look like Neanderthal tools. They don't look like early Homo sapiens tools. They look like they're made by Neanderthals. And that means probably that Neanderthals also were paddling around. And if you think about it, well, you know, a raft or a canoe is not that hard a thing. Well, I take that back. To make a good one is hard. But, you know, if you just want to hop on a log, you can easily, with a stick, you know, you can make your way somewhere, right? But the evidence suggests that not only in the Mediterranean, but also throughout Asia, of course, down to Australia. I mean, how do you think the Aborigines got there? They didn't walk.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. Of course, you know me, I'm Mystic Mark, your host here on today's show. And we've got some amazing sponsors. I'm going to start with, well, a new sponsor, the newest sponsor, and that's Raw Optics. You see, I just had Matt, the CEO and founder of Raw Optics, here on the podcast. The episode will be coming out very soon, and I think you guys are going to be very excited when you see what Raw Optics has to offer, and especially when you hear what Matt has to say. His story was so compelling, very impressive, a young, brilliant guy who cared about his health and did a ton of research and realized that light plays a huge role in our overall health and wellness. So in order to, let's say, block out all this negative light, we need to reconsider our relationship with light, and they've done just that with Raw Optics. They have daytime and nighttime lenses
yellow daytime lenses. So it's really one shade away from normal glasses. It's really all that, not all that different from sunglasses or regular reading glasses. The nighttime frames are very fun red lenses, and this tone is designed specifically to wind you down and get you in that deep relaxation state that our ancient ancestors once enjoyed as they winded down naturally with the sun. Take back your circadian rhythm today with Ra Optics. Use the promo code CRAZYOPTICS and you get 10% off. It's definitely going to help out. I know 10 doesn't sound like a lot, but with sunglasses, it ends up being actually a considerable amount. So definitely consider doing just that and using the promo code, of course, when you buy. But I definitely think that everyone listening is going to benefit from this, especially after listening to Matt himself. So don't take it from me. Matt will explain it all, but go and check it out, rawoptics.com/crazyoptics for all of the details. And yeah, look forward to that interview coming out later this week. Of course, we've got our next newest sponsor, Brain Supreme. That's Brain Supreme. And Brain Supreme has just upped the ante, folks, okay? If you were on the fence, if you were still ever curious about what Brain Supreme could really offer you, well, guess what? You're in luck, because Brain Supreme has put together a free, yes, that's right, free guide, a free course for you to download, for you to check out, for you to just stream right there on your computer. Go and look at it. It is a microdosing course, a breakdown of everything you ever wanted to know about microdosing and didn't know to ask, or maybe you're just too afraid to ask. I mean, why would you be afraid? Your family already thinks you're crazy, but make sure you use the promo code CRAZY15 when checking out with Brain Supreme. That's right, CRAZY15 when checking out with Brain Supreme. And trust me, folks, this is the key that you are looking for to unlock that next level of mental, physical, and spiritual potential, okay? Take it from me, I use Brain Supreme on a weekly to monthly basis. I don't like to microdose too often, but every now and then I find myself in a rut creatively with the podcast, and I will tell you guys candidly, honestly, I have taken Brain Supreme for that purpose, and some of the episodes, you know, hits or not, have been created thanks to Brain Supreme. So your results may vary, but I highly recommend it. And of course, use a promo code CRAZY15. And last but not least, our favorite, our oldest, our best, you know, last but not least, I should say, oldest but not worn out, because the HIIT kit just refreshed, a whole new dress down, dress back up. Everything is brand spanking new. The HIIT kit has all new designs and maybe is going to be in a store near you soon. But use the promo code CRAZY and get your HIIT kit. It's not just good for us smokers and stoners. People who are survivalists, who like to go out camping, can use the HIIT kit to keep your lighter safe and dry. If you find yourself in inclement conditions and you need to rely on a lighter to get a fire started, you can even throw two lighters in a HIIT kit and be double safe, because there's a basically a little storage area, so you can use that storage area for really whatever you want. You can take the lighters, both of the lighters, out and put kindling in there and store dry kindling for an emergency. I mean, the HIIT kit, really, the sky's the limit. Just don't throw it over your head, because it will hurt when it comes back down. But the sky is the limit with the HIIT kit. Use the promo code CRAZY, of course. And this mid-roll has been very long, folks. I know. Geez, wow. Well, here's the chance for me to promote my podcast, right? The supporter side of it, where you're going to get a full breakdown of the film that we talked about today. Although it is available on multiple streaming platforms, including Tubi, which I use to watch it for free. I just had to stomach a few ads
But other than that, which you're doing right now, so I shouldn't speak so low of it, the ads keep the show going. But what really keeps the show going is the support we get from the Patreon and the Substack, the community that's built there, the engagement, everybody who's a part of it, the people who have stuck around. They've become people that I recognize, and I try to go out of my way to communicate with them on Instagram or in the other places. I will admit, I have not gone too much into the Patreon app itself, but now that I have a new phone for filming and for work purposes, I'm going to be using the Patreon app a lot more. And I think I'm going to be live streaming, doing a lot of stuff like that a lot more. So big stuff on the way, but be sure to sign up on the Patreon or the Substack to see it all first. Okay, so with that, we'll be right back to this interview with Jack Kelly after a break to the dynamic ads. Like I said, ad free. What are you waiting for? Sign up on the Patreon or the Substack and you don't have to hear any of this. Just the amazing podcast with our amazing guests that you've come to know and love with me, your host, Mystic Mark. So I'll shut up now and let you guys get back to this interview.
Save big on your next project right now at Menards. Save time on your paint project with help from Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape. Use on walls, trim, glass, wood, or metal for clean removal and clean paint lines every time. Save big and get a 3-pack of Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape on sale now through September 22nd. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Right. Well, and for that matter, all of the Micronesian and Polynesian islands, which are inhabited and have been inhabited in, you know, up into and way before Christopher Cook, right? I almost said Columbus Cook. Captain Cook went and explored a lot of these places. And I mean, yeah, it's really baffling. You mentioned another thing that just sparked a thought, and this was something I had hoped we would eventually talk about, which was, yes, there is a measured rising of the sea levels, but there have been variations where maybe for smaller periods of time within the grand scope of things, cataclysmic events occurred maybe in local areas where water was dispersed, you know, away in a major cataclysm, or you know, brought upon in a major cataclysm, you know, destroying things, or, you know, the inverse, causing drought and famine because of the lack of water, right? So we have this situation going on where not only are the water itself is very vital to this whole equation, but traveling along water. And really, I think, you know, again, I hope I'm not like getting ahead of what you guys are revealing in the film, but you know, when you look at all the problems trying to understand the Great Pyramids, you know, people have all these measurements about rolling stone over logs across great spans of land. It's like, well, what if they had large boats and they floated all this stuff into the, you know, and that's why the quarries are so far away, because the whole entire Sahara was not what it looks like today. So help us understand this, because you guys have done the meteorological, you know, research to prove that there are these massive fluctuations that you can show maybe some areas of the globe were once much different than they are today.
That it's undoubtable. You know, the irony, Mark, is that today we hear so much about climate change, right? You can't practically read a newspaper or a magazine without, you know, touching on that subject. And yet it actually seems that climate change is a key component to this Atlantis story and this geography. Because, you know, and again, we go into this in quite a bit of detail in the film, but there are these major cosmic cycles, right? So a lot of people in kind of some alternative spheres and people who believe in advanced ancient civilizations point out something called the precession of the equinoxes, which just basically means that the tilt of the axis of Earth kind of moves in a circle every roughly 25,000 years, something like that. But there's other things, right? The tilt doesn't always stay the same. It can wobble or alter a few degrees. So that's the second one. And then the third one is, you know, the Earth doesn't move in a circle around the sun. You probably learned this when you're in, like, you know, grade school. It moves in ellipse, right? So the obliquity of the Earth's orbit is the third one. And those three things together are called the Milankovitch cycles, right? So when you stack those things up, and the way I like to explain this to people is like, okay, let's say you leave your car parked outside. Well, if it's a cloudy day, it's not going to heat up too much, but it'll be a little warm in there, right? Now, if the sun's shining, your car is going to be much hotter. And now imagine it's not the fall or the spring, but it's summertime, peak temperatures, longest exposure to the sun. Your car is going to be the hottest it could be. And the variation between leaving your car like that in the summer and the winter is huge. And the variation between if it's a cloudy day or a sunny day, that's also pretty big, right?
Yeah.
So those factors stack up. And what these things do, as we, you know, as I discovered in the process of doing this research and speaking with experts, is they create these macro climate cycles. So like every 20,000 years, give or take, there's a huge cycle in North Africa, which results in something that we call the Green Sahara. And what's so remarkable about this is it completely changes the climate of what in our era and throughout most of history has been just a kind of pretty dead desert. Although there are historical records that show that it was considerably greener along the margins, even a couple thousand years ago, right? So it's been drying out. Like we're at like almost peak dryness of the Sahara right now. So imagine that we're on the opposite side of this cycle. Well, these monsoon belts converge. Like everybody knows that there's these huge rainforest jungles down in the Congo and stuff like that. Just imagine the climatic conditions that create those have moved north, right? And so now what's kind of the southern Sahara is more like the Congo, and the northern Sahara is more like, I don't know, the plains of the Serengeti, right? Imagine these big grasslands with some trees and giraffes and elephants running around and stuff like that. And we can see from the historical habitat that elephants roamed all over North Africa during these periods, right? You're talking about a completely different climate just within the last, call it, 12,000 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's really amazing to think about these huge like belts of moisture and the way they move gradually over time and how the landscape changes to, you know, follow the water, obviously. I can just think of like my father's home and his yard, which is very green and full of life. But just in my own lifetime of only, you know, barely 30 years, I've seen a completely different shift. I mean, some of the trees that are like in my memory are gone. Others are still there, you know, and it's astounding to think like how gradual these little changes happen, but make these huge, huge, like as far as your perspective of the landscape, big changes over, you know, larger pieces of time.
100%. And, you know, when you talk about the Atlantis story, you know, one of the things we do in the Atlantis puzzle documentary is we look at kind of the claims of the story, but we also look at kind of what's implied, right? And so if we say, for example, that the capital city of Atlantis had people trading from all over the known world, well, that implies that there are trade networks that span at least kind of, you know, North Africa and Europe, right? Well, those are the kind of claims that we had to try to investigate. And one of the ones about the climate and sort of this questions of flooding, well, if you're in the middle of the Green Sahara period or at the dawn of the Green Sahara period, circa 9600 BC, you know, and if Serenitatis is correct in this whole, that there was a sort of localized flooding event at the area that was the capital city. And most people, this is no secret, most people are familiar with this from social media, that a lot of people are saying the Rashat structure in Mauritania, this ringed structure that, you know, certainly resembles Plato's description of the geography of the Atlantean capital city. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, people started kind of putting this out online, and I'm not going to name names, but it seems to be that people kind of essentially took this. There was a film that came out, I think, around 2012 called Visiting Atlantis. But it may be the case, and again, I'm not libeling or besmirching anyone's reputation, but it kind of seems like maybe that those people got that idea directly or indirectly from the work of Serenitatis, who was probably 7 or 8 years before that, right? So we're talking 20 years ago, Serenitatis was on to this idea. Well, you know, essentially he sort of said, well, look, the story really doesn't say anything about a fantasy lost continent. It's sort of saying, look, there was some type of civilization here and it got flooded. The capital city got flooded and sort of there was an earthquake and sort of a localized tsunami, right? Well, all of a sudden we've gone from the realm of fringe fantasy Aquaman nonsense to, okay, maybe there was a myth that recorded an actual event. Now, it's a long time ago, so how that myth would have gone through time is a big question. But if it did, if that myth did carry down to Plato's era and he heard about it somehow, right, maybe we are dealing with sort of a story that had its roots in some real event. And when I was looking into the reality of this, I mean, all you got to do is go back to like the flooding of New Orleans to see that even in a modern metropolis can be totally smashed by like a hurricane and flooding, right? So, you know, in about, I want to say maybe 10 or 12 years ago, Mark, there were massive floods in Nigeria, basically just because the monsoon season was like worse than expected. And it... 2 million people were displaced from their homes. Like something like 600,000 or 700,000 homes were destroyed in Nigeria because of flooding. And I mean, this is a modern country. I know it's in Africa and everything, but you know, Nigeria is a developed country.
Right.
It's remarkable. So if you imagine that those type of climatic conditions existed 12,000 years ago, again, at the opposite end of the cycle during the Green Sahara, how hard is it to believe, that, you know, an early, you know, what would have been probably Stone Age civilization that might have had homes made out of adobe or whatever gets hit by massive storms and flooding, that civilization is going to be just crushed, right?
Well, and this has happened in other instances, maybe not as, you know, wide scale as the Atlantis puzzle, but the Trojan civilization, was it the Trojans that, I think I might be misremembering that, but there was a Greek city that was thought to be mythical, not in existence at all, just a total myth. And in fact, they have found the site where Troy, wasn't it Troy and the Trojans?
Yeah, so that you're bringing up a really good point. This is one of my favorite things to talk about, is if you go back 150 years, right? Think about the period you're in. You're in this kind of Victorian era, guys in three-piece suits, and the world is not as connected as it is now. There's not this massive amount of video and global maps and satellites. The only way to find out about stuff is to get on, you know, get on a train or get on a horse or get on a boat and go out there and find it, right? So Troy, right? The Trojan War is contained in it's the story of the Iliad, right? Which is the sort of, I don't want to say Bible, but the sort of classic myth of Greek education is the Iliad and the Odyssey, these two books that were written allegedly by Homer, right? Who was supposedly a blind poet. And those stories go back, the events of the Trojan War go back to like the 12th century BC. At the time of kind of the, you know, call it mid to late 1800s, a lot of people thought that Troy was just a myth, right? Because there are mythological elements to the story. You know, there's gods and there's heroes and there's this and there's that. There's this great war and there's a destruction. It's a very archetypal epic story. So a lot of people had sort of said, well, this is just a story. It's just a myth. And there was this guy named Heinrich Schliemann who was sort of an amateur archaeologist. And he took this team and he basically went to where the Iliad kind of said Troy was, and he started poking around and he had people tell him about some unusual features or ruins or so forth. He went there and started digging. Lo and behold, he found what is now acknowledged to be Troy. And now the layers, the crazy thing is there were at least 9 layers, I think, of different cities that had risen, been destroyed, and been rebuilt, right, over who knows how many thousands of years. I'm sure this has been looked into, but the layer he actually thought was Troy turned out not to be the historic one. So, but archaeology, what I'm getting at is archaeology was not a developed science. 150 years ago, it was just getting going. So everything we take for granted today about carbon dating and, you know, stratigraphy and textbooks full of knowledge about places like Egypt and stuff like that, nobody had that, Mark. So we're at the dawn of a period back then when, you know, I think people who have a deep interest in the ancient world were getting super excited because Troy, which was so long thought to be a myth, boom, we found it. Next place he went was Mycenae, which never entirely disappeared. It's in the Peloponnesian peninsula in Greece, but it had totally fallen into ruin. And I've been to Mycenae, and it's a remarkable site, but in a way it had kind of become lost. Like Greece, people kind of forget Greece had kind of gotten depopulated during the 1800s and so forth. They were under the control of the Ottoman Empire. So a lot of people had scooted out of Greece. Their population took a huge dive. So a lot of stuff had just kind of gotten lost or gone into ruin. And Schliemann also started digging at Mycenae, and lo and behold, he uncovered treasures. You've probably seen that image, the mask, the death mask of Agamemnon, which is this kind of golden death mask. Probably not from the actual Agamemnon, but it demonstrated, hey, look, there were people here at this time period. Certainly, this was a place of importance, and it started to shed light. And I think that was the opening shot of modern archaeology's day in the sun was these discoveries like, hey, guys, all this awesome stuff is just, we just got to dig and we got to understand, you know, we got to come up with some system of dating stuff. Yeah.
Well, and it does seem like we're in a really great time for these types of discoveries to be made. It seems like, you know, although academia is a little bit biased when it comes to this topic in general, there are avenues like this one and the other, you know, obviously big outlets are covering topics like this that are giving play to alternative takes on this. And I think that's allowing for, you know, the tables to turn a bit. For too long, the academics have kind of stifled this topic and not given a chance for people like Mr. Serenitis to really do its due diligence and put the pieces together.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we also have to be really careful, though, Mark, because I just want to point out that Serenitatis, nowhere does he claim, and I've had many conversations with him, he doesn't claim that the events of the Atlantis story in the Platonic manuscripts are true. He doesn't claim that there was a civilization exactly like the one that's described, you know, in Western Africa during the Green Sahara. He's merely pointing out this is where the geography was. And if we're going to uncover everything, you got to send teams of archaeologists out there to determine, well, what was actually there during this time period, right? So again, we have to be a little bit careful not to say, because certainly, you know, the descriptions of places and the ruins we actually find or the evidence we find, like, for example, out at the Rashat structure in Western Africa, which is, you know, supposedly this is the place where, you know, Plato was ascribing to in Atlantean capital city. They found lots of stone tools there. Archaeologists have been out there. And what nobody has found is a massive set of ruins that resembled the city in the myth. But they found a lot of stone tools, which means people were living there at some point, right? And it looks like those tools are from kind of the late Pleistocene, early Holocene, because there's been so much water impact at that site because of the Green Sahara. What happens is that a lot of these tools get kind of washed down into these sandy depressions in between the rings of stone. And so I think that makes some of the dating a little trickier. But if you look at the types of tools that were in use, certainly they resemble stuff going back, you know, 10 to 15,000, 20,000 years ago. So again, I think we want to be careful when we open the door to stuff. You're right. This might be a period that's very similar to the dawn of modern archaeology, but a lot of mistakes were made. A lot of things were misattributed at the dawn of modern archaeology, right? And one of my favorite historical figures is the archaeologist Flinders Petrie. And if you've looked into Egypt, you've probably come, you can't help but come across Flinders Petrie, right? He was sort of the father of modern archaeology. And I've loved reading his books. And one of the things that you come across is he's often sort of says, we just keep finding out, you know, essentially how ignorant we are about the past, or it just keeps going back, and we really realize that we don't fully understand the timeline. Well, as it happens, well, Egypt's a totally different subject, but a timeline has been established, and all these academics are not total morons, right? They've done good work, but it doesn't mean that there's not room for further exploration. And that's one of the exciting things about this film is what you realize, Mark, is you also brought this up to your point. There's all new knowledge comes about at the intersection of what's known and what's unknown, right? Because if you see something that's completely unknown and you weren't looking for it, it's just noise, right? It's just atmospheric background. You don't attribute any importance to it. But and if something is known, well, then you already know what it is, and it's doesn't really add too much to your information set. But, you know, think about in the sciences, if you're at the, you know, what was that thing, the Large Hadron Collider or whatever, and you're finding some, you know that, 247 subatomic particles exist, and all of a sudden you think you might find evidence of another one, boom, you find another one. Well, now there's 248. Has this changed what you're going to eat for breakfast tomorrow? No, but it has expanded the knowledge. All the textbooks that said there were 247 are now wrong. 248 is now the minimum, right? So I think that this is what you're talking about to a certain extent. Like, I know guys like Graham Hancock and who's that other guy? Is it Tucker Carlson or what's his name?
It's definitely not Tucker Carlson.
Not Tucker Carlson. Sorry. What's his name?
Well, there's a couple of gentlemen that come to mind for me. There's Robert Scott Schock. There's Laird Scranton. There's Andrew Collins. I mean, there's what's his name who goes on Joe Rogan as well. And now I'm blanking. But yeah, there's plenty of guys like Graham Hancock.
There's plenty of guys out there, and I think, Hancock's always sort of saying, well, we got to look at the continental shelves. And he's right from the standpoint that the sea and humanity have had this long-standing relationship. And so people like to live by coastlines. Mm-hmm. And it seems that fishing and foraging along coastlines has been gone hand in hand with human evolution. There's lots of evidence in favor of that. What I don't think we're going to find is evidence of some kind of global lost empire, right? I mean, I think that there's a lot of reasons for that. But I do think that we are at a moment where you are uncovering a lot of things. And we're finally at the point where, whether it's amateur researchers or professional academics, people are starting to push the boundaries right. of what was known. And I think we got into a little bit of a static period in the 20th century where people kind of felt like they had it all figured out. And this is true throughout history, right? So it's not that we're all just bad people from the last 100 years, right? It's punctuated equilibrium is this thing that's used to describe evolution, right? And it's like there's long periods where there's no change, then all of a sudden there's some big change and things transform, and then there's another static period.
Right.
Well, that appears to, I would say we're in a period where things are getting shaken up, and we're finding discoveries like the White Sands footprints, where something that was essentially the academic position for decades, which was they called the Clovis people hypothesis, was that North America had been peopled, I don't know, around 14,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, right. in conjunction
land
with that.
Crossing over the Bering Strait, right.
Crossing over the Bering Strait. And before that, nobody had ever been here. Now, there were always little bits of evidence that suggested that theory was wrong. Mm. But there was so much evidence that suggested that theory made a hell of a lot of sense that people would sort of disregard these right. minor anomalies. And if you think about it, that's a very reasonable stance. And for people who get mad at the academics, don't get mad at them, because they're drawing a conclusion that makes a lot of sense, right? So for an academic, when there's 95% evidence that says that the Clovis hypothesis is correct, to say, well, actually, people have been here for 10,000 years before that, well, you actually, you do look kind of stupid, because people are going to say, hey, Frank, you know, what about all this evidence that suggests X? And maybe those couple random things that got found on this coastline, maybe those were dated wrong. Or maybe Dr. Smith was a little sloppy with his research, or maybe those finds were contaminated, right? You can kind of explain that stuff away. But, and this is, I don't know if you ever heard of a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn.
No, but before we leave it was Randall Carlson you were thinking of, not
Randall
Tucker Carlson,
not Tucker Carlson. Very sorry, similar names, sorry to both of those gentlemen.
No, it's fine. I just couldn't let us escape that. But no, I haven't heard of this book, no.
Yeah, so Thomas Kuhn wrote this, I think it was in the 60s, and it was kind of a radical reshaping of how we think about the advancement of science. Because basically what he's saying is something very similar to punctuated equilibrium, right? It's this idea that an idea forms about how the world is. In his case, he's talking about sciences, right? And that idea persists as long as it's the best answer to explain all the evidence, right? And invariably, eventually, as our knowledge grows, we're going to run up against things that don't fit the theory. But we don't just throw the theory out because one or two random things don't really seem to fit, if there's a good reason not to, right? We might dismiss that and say, again, this data doesn't look right. This doesn't fit. There must be something wrong with that research, right? You know, this needs to be further demonstrated, right? This needs to be repeated, this experiment. And therefore, we're not just going to throw out the scientific theories of our modern day because one or two little things question it, right? But over a certain period of time, the amount of evidence that this theory does not explain is going to grow, Mark. And when it reaches kind of a critical point, now you're going to have this kind of battle between the, I'll just say the sort of traditionalists and the, let's call them the modernists, right? And the traditionalists are going to say, look, this theory has held up great for a long time. It's really good. It explains a lot of stuff, like the Clovis theory. Look, we know the glaciers were melting. We can see there's all these Clovis people from this time period. We don't have much evidence from before. But when you're faced with solid radiocarbon dating by U.S. National Geologic Survey scientists that shows that these footprints are 23,000 years old, case closed. The Clovis hypothesis was wrong.
Right.
And the danger is that, and this is natural, right? Because, again, if we go back 60 years to propose that people had been here for 20, 30, 40,000 years before the Clovis people would have been unfounded, pretty unfounded speculation, right? It could have been a little dangerous. And this, Mark, I think the reason I've gone on this little diatribe is that I think there's a little bit of a tendency among the fringe community to jump to conclusions.
Guilty.
Well, it's exciting. It's interesting right. to think well,
and,
about
and,
these
and
ideas.
A lot of times the bar is so high to engage in these topics on an academic level that you almost, I mean, and this is probably more about me than anyone else, but I feel like the fantasy is more alluring because it's more approachable than, you know, oh, well, you can't really make an informed opinion about that unless you've read these 30 textbooks first, right? And that's such a daunting task for a lot of people who are truly just passionate about these questions, these mysteries that are really interesting. And I'm fully in support of your diatribe. I think it's very reasonable and makes a lot of sense. I have an example of that only 30 minutes away from me. They built an overpass over the Farmington River and discovered a pre-Clovis site of, I guess, Native American, you know, tools of some kind, you know, evidence of them being there. So yeah, pushing the calendar back little by little, the timeline expands and we realize that, you know, our scope of understanding, you know, has to grow to meet, you know, it's like the punctuated equilibrium. We have to adapt with this expansion, with this massive change. And it's very interesting because, you know, with everything we've talked with everything we've talked about tonight, you know, I'm still stuck on the anomalies within North and South America. And I think, you know, to your point, I don't know that we will ever be able to prove something like the existence of a global civilization, but maybe that's a limitation that we're faced with right now. Maybe that's something that is inherent to the nature of a global civilization, right? I mean, maybe it's something that is hard to prove. But on that note, you mentioned the peat bog discovery. And there have been similar discoveries here in the United States. We've found, you know, what appears to be, and this is very controversial, European peoples here in North America prior to, you know, way, way prior to Columbus, and they found them in peat bogs. And these have become very controversial. We spoke to Preston Douglas here on the show who wrote a book about how this, well, it was a part of a book that, you know, deals with controversial archaeological topics, some that have been kind of swept under the rug or maybe misconstrued because of their ramifications. And there are other peat bog discoveries that fall in line with that that are underreported, some in Florida, which, you know, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. There have been giant skeleton finds in some of these places, right? So when you're talking about not only, you know, people who don't necessarily match the description, but then also anatomical characteristics that don't really even match our understanding of what a Homo sapien is, it kind of makes me think of what you said prior about the Neanderthal and how maybe these, you know, this species of hominid was moving around on canoes too. And if that's the case, maybe, what is it, Denisovans and other variants of what we now think of as, you know, humans, you know, maybe not Homo sapien, but human, existed all over the planet. And, you know, that being said, we have the Sasquatch or the wild man myth that, you know, has pervaded all cultures throughout time. So with all that being said, I mean, what are your thoughts on some of these giants and with the prowess of the Atlanteans from what we've gotten from Plato's translations? Like, could that be maybe a match to some of the things we hear about in North and South America, anomalous beings, possibly giant stature, so on and so forth?
Well, I got to tell you, Mark, I'm not up on the giants and so forth, but certainly there has been evidence out there in South America that has upended previous ideas, and it's all come about in the last couple decades. And one of those, I'll just make one example, is it was long thought that the Amazon jungle was never highly populated and that it wasn't home to a lot of people. That's a massive area of South America, right? And then a lot of discoveries within the last couple decades have demonstrated that that's totally wrong. And the prior thinking on that was that, you know, the population of the Amazon never exceeded 1 to 2 million people. Well, kind of overnight, with the discovery, I say overnight, but, you know, over the course of 5-6 years of people doing research, that estimate has now, again, within the academic community, jumped to something like 14 or 15 million people. Well, basically what we're sort of saying is, this is pre-Columbus, of course, what we're sort of saying is that our previous estimate of the population of a massive area of the world was off by like a factor of 7, right? Like if I said, what's the population today? And you told me, well, Jack, it's probably about 8 billion people. Or I said, what's the population today, Mark? And you said, well, Jack, it's probably about 65 billion people. There's a big damn difference between those right. two things. So I think, you know, what we're, again, I do think we're at a period of discovery because, you know, our tools are getting better. We're finding new ways to look at the things that have been there the whole time.
Right.
And this is the irony, right? All this stuff has been there, decaying and degrading. So actually, the farther in time we go, the harder it's going to be to find stuff out. Because as you pointed out, just like in your dad's yard, you know, that old tree dies, or, you know, there's a bad storm 1 year, washes out his garden, he's got to replant it, you know. The landscape's always changing, and literally everything is always in this process of loss. And this is one of the biggest things that came to me through doing the research for the Atlantis puzzle, was trying to look at how do archaeologists work? How do we understand what happened in the past? Like, how do you, sitting there at home, how do you know what happened 100 years ago? Well, you can go read some books. You can go to a museum. We can see what happened in the Civil War. Like, you can be like, wow, geez, there's a musket ball. Clearly, this story about people shooting each other with muskets or you know, these non-rifled guns has some merit. This looks pretty legit. I can see it for myself. Well, you go back 500 years, the amount of physical evidence from the Civil War is high. You go back 500 years, well, how much evidence is there from 500 years ago? Physical stuff, clothes people wore and guns and stuff. Well, you can still see some of that stuff in museums, right? Well, now go back 2,500 years, right? And you find, you know, fragments of Greek helmets and stuff in museums. Well, how come we don't have like 100 of these helmets? Well, because they've corroded, they've disappeared, they're gone, or they got melted down by later people. So the farther back in time you go, the more the evidence deteriorates, right? So if, for example, there were new species or variants of species that we didn't know about, the evidence piecing those together, and I think you mentioned the Denisovans, well, we only have these little bits of it, and maybe most of it's gone. So unless we can find more of it, or unless our research methods continue to improve, it's going to be really hard to piece together, like, where did the Denisovans live? What was their way of life? Like, did they have, what kind of languages did they speak? how would we ever figure that out, right? I mean, we may never know what language Denisovan spoke or anything like that. But the point is, I guess, to say that I don't know about the specific cases that you're talking about, but I think it's certainly the case that we are in a time of discovery and that our picture of the ancient world, or kind of let's call it the pre-modern world, is drastically in a process of change.
Yeah. Well said. I think that's a great place to leave people to watch the film. And there are so many questions in this larger mystery that is, you know, who are we? Where are we from? What is our history? And yeah, I'm, you know, very, very interested to see where you go next. You already hinted at, you know, a film about, you know, discovering maybe more about seafaring. But if you ever do stumble upon the topic of giants, there's plenty to find up here in New England. So please do get in touch with me, because I'd love to show you some of the things that I've found and I've researched. And you'd be surprised what kind of megalithic stones, and that's not an exaggeration, are just, you know, on your casual hike through what you think is just a regular state forest. And there's no plaque, there's no, hey, this has been here for how long or whatever. It's just there. And sure, it could just be a glacial erratic that got pushed by the ice. And yeah, sure. But I don't know many glaciers that take time to turn a stone into the shape of a bird and then place it on another stone. So anyways, enough about that. Jack, you're truly a great pleasure to have on the show here. I'd love to have you back on again in the future. But just one more time, remind the folks where they can find the film and more from yourself and anything else you plan on working on in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. AtlantisPuzzle.com. We've got all the links to all the different platforms. If you want to check out the film on Amazon or, you know, check it out on your preferred platform, they'll all be up there. And the other thing I'd just like to ask people is, you know, my company is a small independent film company. If you like the film, you check it out and you enjoy it, give it a positive rating on Amazon or IMDb. It really, really helps in this bizarre world we live in, where our lives are governed by these algorithms. And, you know, for sort of smaller independent companies to try and compete with, you know, Sony Pictures and MGM and all these giants, it's extremely difficult. So, you know, any positive support, surely appreciated. And I would also just say to people, hey, stay curious. You know, go out there and read the original source material. Don't rely on some secondhand report or so-and-so said, or even Professor Smith said. Go back, read the primary sources yourself. Go back and read research papers. You know, you mentioned the barriers to understanding, but you'd be surprised. You go back and you go read 30 papers on the Green Sahara, you're going to have just as accurate a picture as any lay person who's not a scientist can have.
Right.
So I want to point out to people, yeah, there are barriers, but, you know, they are surmountable. And as you can tell by the books behind Mark and behind me, you know, you can buy books, you can still get them. People still read them. And there's wonderful, wonderful things to be uncovered, both that we know about in the ancient world and that we're just starting to discover. So stay curious, stay hungry, go out there, read as much as you can. And I look forward to continuing our conversation sometime in the future, Mark.
Boom. Photo finish. Well said. And folks, please go follow up and watch the film. And until next time, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our conversation with Jack Kelly. If you want to hear me break down the film, The Atlantis Puzzle, which is available on multiple streaming platforms, and you can go to theatlantispuzzle.com to find all the information. That'll take you to Empire Builder Productions, where you can find all the info on Atlantis, the Atlantis Puzzle, which I think is really the next level when it comes to information and research on Atlantis. This really cuts all of the wheat from the chaff. and gives people just the hard evidence, the cold, hard facts, okay? No pauses. That's right. Cold and hard, okay? So, no pauses. don't pause the film either. Jack's a great guy. Very interesting conversation in the documentary itself with Mr. Santitis, who is mentioned in our conversation today. So, anyways, folks, thank you again for tuning in. Again, if you want to hear my full breakdown of the film, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack, where you'll get this extended edition of this episode, plus bonus content and the engagement of being a part of a community of like-minded crazy folks. You can talk to me, you can talk to them. I'll definitely respond to your Patreon messages. If you send me a message, I always get back to people. If I haven't gotten back to you, prove it to me, because I'm almost certain that I've gotten back to literally everyone who's ever signed up to the Patreon, which I cannot say. I've the same is true for people who hit me up on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, or any of the ratings that we get, including the one-star rating and review that we got about the Dr. Amon Hillman interview, which some Dr. Amon Hillman fanatic was upset with the fact that I have a show where I put stuff behind the paywall. So go F yourself, Dr. Hillman. I deleted your episode. I don't want your energy on my podcast. And yeah, no disrespect to any of his beloved cult-like followers, but I just feel like that whole energy is kind of gross and it's just starts up fights, and I'm probably asking for a fight by saying this, but I'm really not, so don't come after me because you'll just be ignored. But yeah, I don't really like it, nor do I tolerate it. So I just said, you know what? If people are going to say nasty things because they don't like the way I interviewed this guy who said a bunch of nasty stuff on my podcast, well, guess what? I'm just going to delete the whole podcast. So goodbye, Dr. Amon Hillman. And I feel really bad for staining this excellent episode with that, but it needed to be addressed because that's how I roll, mother suckers. So that's just what it is. And yeah, I don't care if you guys want to leave a one-star review, whatever. I mean, whoever does that, like, there's just bad karma coming your way in the end. But, you know, giving a rating for a podcast episode isn't really fair, considering that the rating system is designed to rate the entire podcast, not just one episode. So if you're going to be a fair weather freak and listen to one episode and then move on and leave like a really stinky rating, well, I'm going to call you an Audio Karen. So goodbye, Audio Karen, and Dr. Hillman. You can take your Audio Karens with you because I don't want your episode on my feed anymore. It's still available for my supporters because, you know, why not see the truth of it all if you're so inclined to support me in this free podcast that I give out for free with ads on it that generate some money, but still. I mean, this is not, you know, my time is not free. The effort that's put into this podcast is not free. So it is what it is. You can complain all you want about paywalling the content that you love, but guess what? Dr. Amon Hillman, that's on him, okay? He decided to join my podcast. He should have done the research and seen that that's what I do for certain episodes. And if he had a problem with it, he could have reached out to me, which he didn't. So guess what? I'm deleting the episode. Anyways, that's all I'll say about that. And if you want to support me and you want to support the show and find all the bonus episodes, even the deleted ones, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack for $5 and you can go suck yourself. Haters on the internet leaving one-star reviews because I don't sweat it. I just say all this right here in this outro and then it's in, you know, over my shoulder and out of my life. That's the thing. Like people, you know, they hear you say this and they're like, oh, look, Mark's getting. No, I don't care. I'm just addressing it and moving on. If it becomes an issue, well, I've already addressed it. So I don't need to reiterate it. Don't come after me like some kind of troll. That's immaturity, and we don't need that. I just got a little bone to pick with people who leave one-star reviews on my podcast. I think that's fair, considering I put a lot of effort into this podcast. So anyways, if you want to support that effort, again, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack, and please support today's guest, most importantly of all, support today's guest, because he was kind enough to share his time with me, and he didn't have to, you know. It's not like I have the money to pay my guests. I have the money to pay my bills and create this podcast, which is a blessing. So I appreciate all of you who are listening. Even if you're not supporting the show, I still appreciate you and love you. Don't take this the wrong way. You know, I'm only directing that negative energy at that one-star reviewer, and I guess I'll just leave it at that. Otherwise, it's going to stink up the rest of this recording. So yeah, The Atlantis Puzzle is an amazing film. I watched it today because, listen, I don't like to interview the guest after I've watched their film. It's just, it just doesn't put me in a good place to interview. I end up like repeating things that happen in the film, and it seems like that makes the guest a little upset because they're trying to allude to these things so that you'll watch the film, right? So in order to avoid that, I just don't watch the film. That way we can talk about whatever we want, and I don't feel bad because, hey, I didn't watch the film. But now I watched the film, and I can endorse it to you guys as you're hearing it. So in your mind, oh, this is all happening in one day. No, I interviewed Jack like last week, right? So this episode's coming out after I've watched the film, and I honestly love it. It's really good. Really kind of shakes up what most people think of Atlantis, including myself. I mean, I falsely have said many times that maybe Atlantis was in the Atlantic. And I still think there might be a possibility of sunken islands, but I think Jack has proven pretty thoroughly that there are no sunken continents. Maybe shrouded continents, but not sunken continents. Pretty cool stuff. I'm glad to be proven wrong. That's part of learning, right? So no ego in that, just straight facts. And with that, we're going to wrap this episode up. Sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. I'll remind you guys again if you're not already annoyed. And guess what? I don't repeat that if you're signing up and you support. You just get the interview with the information and none of the promo, none of the banter about how I'm paying the bills or whatever. Just get the good stuff. Cut out all the fat. This is, you know, this is just to get the barnacles to, you know, slide off the boat so we can speed off into podcast millionaireville. But anyways, all right, we're gonna wrap this up. Peace. Thank you for listening, and immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
Atlantis, a land that harnessed the power of a volcano's fiery heart and learned to store the energy of the sun in giant crystals, then use them to create secret weapons whose disintegrating rays could destroy the rest of the world.
I've been hooked like phonics since geometric platonic solids first solidified in my conscience. An enigmatic, spastic, autodidactic, mystery scholastic. Got drastic with Spartan tactics, Atlantis scholar stretching facts like mental gymnastics. Stepped into a scripted, systematic, circular logic labyrinth. Walls collapsing, all nails to a hammer and a casket. Basket cases can't grasp it. Athens barred access to the past on a lost path. To the last breath, at a vast depth, violent fast death, flash floods and the mud crept, smothered souls slept, left forgotten as the sand swept, only the stones left, old bones kept with the chip tool set, figured in a book only dust collects, relics that merely resurrect, archaeology's sense of false confidence.
Atlantean draconoids rose to prominence, eventually gained dominance, their power grew ominous, loomed over the populace, enslaved in the crystalloid metropolis.
I reject lost continents. I said I reject lost continents.
Whatever the Atlantis myth once represented has been washed from our minds by a tsunami of pop culture.
We actually find, or the evidence we find, like for example, out of the Rashat structure in Western Africa, which is, you know, supposedly this is the place where, you know, Plato was ascribing to in Atlantean capital city. They found lots of stone tools there. Archaeologists have been out there. And what nobody has found is a massive set of ruins that resemble the city in the myth. But they found a lot of stone tools, which means people were living there at some point, right? Because there's been so much water impact at that site because of the Green Sahara, what happens is that a lot of these tools get kind of washed down into these sandy depressions in between the rings of stone.